Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Lorraine. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast for take two of our conversation. The last time you and I talked, we had recorded the conversation back, I think it was probably February, maybe early March, and then COVID-19 came along and we decided the conversation got a little stale and maybe a little disconnected. So we're going to have you back. We're going to have a conversation here today. But before we have that conversation, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Lorraine Goodman. And although I come from the development, I am currently the interim executive director at the Latin American Legal Defense and Education Fund, which is also known as LALDEF. We serve the Mercer County immigrant communities, and we're located in Trenton, New Jersey.
So, Lorraine, when we talked before, if I remember correctly, you are also an actress or former actress or something of that. So how does that work? Do actresses, are you a recovering actress? How does that work?
Yeah. I was, for about 20 some odd years, I was a performer on Broadway. I think I was always involved in fundraising to some extent because when I started performing on Broadway was at the height of the AIDS epidemic in New York, which the Broadway community was severely hit, obviously.
Yeah.
And I almost immediately got involved with Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, and got very involved with that effort to raise money for that community. So that was sort of the beginning of my volunteer work as a development person, fundraising, although I was always involved with my university fundraising for their annual fund. And it wasn't until after 9/11 hit, actually, that I went back to school and got my master's in nonprofit administration with a concentration in development.
And so, Lorraine, I've got to ask you, so what productions were, because my kids, just the other day, we watched the film version of Rent, and I was able to tell my kids that I had actually seen Rent with the original cast. And I think that was, I think the New York cast was doing that in, I think that was like 97, 98, something like that. So what were like the productions, the big productions at the time when you were up there?
Sure. So the first show I did on Broadway was The Mystery of Edwin Drood. So that was the first one I did. Then I actually went to Vienna, Austria, and did Cats.
Wow.
Yeah, I did Grisabella in Cats. She sang Memory, the big show, big song.
Yeah.
And then I came back to New York. I did some regional theater. I did some stuff in Canada, of all places. And then I ended up back on Broadway doing Les Miserables on Broadway. And I did that for about a year and a half. And then I left that to go on to more happy pastor, shall we say, and ended up back on Broadway a few years later doing a play called Masterclass. It was a Pulitzer nominee. I don't think it won, but it was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. It did win the Tony Award. It's a play about Maria Callas, written by Terrence McNally, starring Zoe Caldwell and Audra McDonald. And I actually covered Audra and some other roles, and then went on in that role over 100 times. And then shortly after that show closed, I went back to Europe and starred in Phantom of the Opera for 2 years.
Fascinating. That is. I'm going to share this with my daughter, Christina, my older daughter. So we have two girls and two boys, and I've taken the girls. I took the girls over to see Kinky Boots a couple of years ago. When the two guys that were playing the lead parts came back for sort of a reunion. This was New Year's. 2 years, two years ago, I think they came back and did the original parts. Wow. And of course Broadway is shut down now. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, you've got to have an opinion about that.
Well, first of all, I was going to tell you that Billy Porter, I did Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Really?
Billy Porter, his first Equity show. Yep.
Yes, and that's yes, right. He and who's the other guy that plays opposite with him in Kinky Boots?
Remember the other guy.
Yeah, but those are the two lead roles in Kinky Boots. And my two daughters fell in love with the idea of Broadway, and we were going to go back every year. But this last year, obviously because of COVID related reasons, we haven't been able to get back.
Yeah.
But so, what's your thoughts on sort of what's going on over there? I mean, how long do you think it's going to be? Can it recover? I mean, it's Broadway. It can't go away forever.
Well, you know, I mean, the Broadway, I think, will come back because those are individual shows, and the companies can close and not expend more money. And that's commercial theater. I'm more concerned about the nonprofit theater world because. You know, the Metropolitan Opera, for example, and that is just a machine. It's, I think, the largest nonprofit performing arts organization in the world, has the largest budget. And they just announced recently that they aren't going to do anything until January 22.
Wow.
You know, it's not just the shows and the theaters. It's the people who work there. You know, with unemployment, where are they going to work? Some people are very good at finding other jobs, but unemployment's running out. It's bad. I think a lot of them are in New York City, and a lot of things are closing in New York. You know, the people that sustain that economy, and it's a huge economy. It's actually approximately 1% of New York City's budget.
Wow.
Which is huge if you think about, because Wall Street is also there, right?
Yeah.
It's closed down.
Yeah, I had not thought about that, but you're right. The business model, the underlying business model for Broadway, for productions, is resilient, I guess you could say. It can sort of, because it's designed to sort of start and stop and come and go, and that's the way those business models are designed. But it's the other aspects and the other ways that some of the other parts of theater and the performing arts and stuff that are not structured that way. that perhaps can't be as resilient.
And it's the people you don't see, you know, the
right,
people on
right.
stage, they can get jobs, but it's,
right.
You know, the people who usually, you know, either the gypsies who went from show to show to show
yeah.
on stage, or the people who go literally backstage show to show to show, running the sets and the costumes and the, they say, you know, every time for every two people you see on stage, there are like 10 people backstage.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, the other thing I wanted to ask you before we dive into our subject today, you had mentioned that you have gotten involved with Richard Perry and Jeff Schreibel's, you've done their Major Gift, I think their Major Gift fundraising course or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I have been talking about partnering with them and helping create some additional promotional efforts for them. What's your thoughts on that program? How'd that work for you?
I thought it was terrific, actually. Of all the things I've ever done, it was certainly the most detailed and specific, like really specific ideas that you can take back with you. I think we've all talked a lot about the, you know, large ideas in terms of being donor-centric, right?
Yeah.
In terms of being, you know, doing the homework, doing the research, all those things. This was a lot more specific. They have this this marketing impact chart, because studies have shown that it takes approximately 7 soft touches to get a significant gift.
Sure.
And this chart, which is kind of extraordinary, lays out your monthly, and you can plan out your monthly touches. What are your touches? When does the person normally give? What is your ask going to be? And how do you lead up to that in this big Excel spreadsheet? They also have these practice sessions where you practice a technique where they talk about making sure that you bring the donor to the scene, right? So that they get the mission. And then you follow this asking the donor along the way, I'd like to show you this, or I'd like to talk about that. So that you put the donor in control of the conversation, even if they don't want to be, or they're not seeming like they will take control of the conversation, but you give them permission. And I thought that was a very, they were scripts that we had to practice. And you called up a friend. I mean, we did it over Zoom. And I actually practiced some of these asks. And, creating, you know, the first meeting, the second meeting over Zoom specifically, because right now we really can't do a lot of in-person meetings.
Yeah. Yeah. So you went through, if I understand it, because I've only gotten to know Jeff, and I have done some speaking engagements together, and we've bantered around the idea of ways that we might partner together. But this is the Major Gift Academy. Powered by the Veritas Group. Is that right? That's what it's called?
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah. 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 Part of the intriguing aspects of what Jeff and I have talked about is the idea that a lot of the training that we do here at Responsive, and we talk about what's called the messy middle lane, is essentially the training that Jeff and his team are essentially training up people like yourself to be very comfortable doing. It's that messy space that a lot of organizations don't know how to develop a commitment to, and that is sort of after the initial gift, those gifts that we generally get through new acquisition and special events and so forth. And it's before those sort of those legacy and capital campaign contributions, but it's also where the relationships come alive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a conversation. I met with a large donor of LALDEF last week, I guess it was. And we had a very specific need in the organization. And prior to the conversation with the donor, I was told by two other board members that, we've had like three, we've visited him a couple of times and we've always asked him for, you know, if he'll increase his gift. And he always says, yeah, I'll think about it. And then he does the same thing that he's always done. And I, you know, I'm hoping, but I don't think it's going to happen, blah, 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 blah. So I said, well, let's go in with a little bit different approach. And I went in there and these two board members accompanied me, and we had a lovely conversation at first. but I could see one of the board members kind of wanting to fall back on her old ways, so to speak, to say, we need this money and please give it to us. And I, you know, I gently controlled the conversation a little bit more to let David control it and get involved. And I brought him to the scene. I told him this story of someone brought to our organization a huge pile of practically new toys for little girls. Yeah. And his kids had grown up and he didn't, you know, and some of these things were, he was clearly from a very wealthy family. And some of these things were very in excellent shape and had probably never even been used. And while he was bringing the stuff into our conference room, there was a young couple with a little girl waiting to be get their ID cards. And I said to the guy, would you like to give that little girl one of these dolls? And he was like, yeah. He goes over and he hands the girl the doll. And I turned to the family and I said, uno regalo, which means, you know, it's a gift. And the little girl was like clutching the doll and looking at her parents and they were smiling and nodding and everyone just started crying. It was this beautiful moment. The guy was so happy, you know, and I said to this gentleman on the call when I told him the story is that this is what your gift will do. It will make people so happy. Yeah. And 10 minutes after the meeting, he sent us an email and said he was basically giving us 4.5 times the size of his normal gift. And it was the largest gift our organization has ever gotten from an individual.
Yeah, there is that 4.5 times. Yeah. There's sort of a rule that we oftentimes coach development officer, the rule of five. I think the rule of five was taught to me probably the first couple of years of my major gift work. And it's that idea that, you know, engaging with an individual in a meaningful way, you know, you can anticipate 5 times that initial gift.
Wow.
and that's just what we were taught. I don't remember who that was taught. That was what somebody taught that to us. And so we, and I've checked that with you know, coaches and consultants and so forth. And I don't hear that sort of practice a whole lot, but the idea that, for example, a major gift officer will oftentimes look at the first gift that a donor gave. Then if he or she is meeting with a donor, you know, meeting with them to solicit a gift, he or she will, if they don't have any other information, they'll ask for a contribution of 5 times. Yeah.
Wow. I never heard that before. That's fascinating. Yeah. And that's
it's kind of the assumption that it's not so much signaling. It's not so much signaling what their capabilities are, but it's kind of drawing an assumption that that initial gift was perhaps not terribly reflective of what their capabilities are.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes they're not. Oftentimes that first gift, I think the practice is less about the actual gift you're asking for. And it's more about the idea that chances are that first gift just wasn't reflective of a much of a commitment and not likely to be renewed and a number of other things.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's such a thing. I mean, we did have a menu of options that we provided to this gentleman. That was based more on anecdotal evidence about his ability, because we don't have the budget to support a subscription to iWave or Wellfin.
Right, right. Right.
So, and a precursory, you know, Google search found out that this gentleman liked to spread his money around. Every donation I found was in the realm of what he normally gave to LALDEF. So, you know, it was, I don't know what our expectations were going in, but the donation he gave will allow us to go forward with our need. So that's quite nice, and I think it will change our organization dramatically.
So when you and I met before, you had some opinions and some ideas about segmentation, and the world has changed since then. Mm-hmm. It's changed in two ways. We are limited in our abilities to engage with, you know, if we develop a segmented list of donors. How we get in front of them in meaningful ways is limited. Yeah. A lot of us are relying on things like, you know, Zoom and other sort of virtual platforms, even things like what you and I are working off of right now. And then things like the sort of the social unrest and the Black Lives Matter and sort of the idea that perhaps I had somebody here on the podcast recently. We were talking about, you know, does segmentation in some way sort of overlook particular categories of donors? And how do we ensure that we're sort of engaging, a population of donors that will be totally representative of who we want our donors to be long term and who our donors should be? And that we're not just necessarily simply looking at the people who are sort of a guaranteed, check. So what's your thought? How has your thoughts changed, or have they changed? I don't quite frankly even remember maybe what your opinions were. So let's hear what you think.
I think it's still, I apologize. I still think it's important to customize the messaging and learning, you know, what your different level of donor, or not even level of donor, but perhaps the, meeting your donor where they are.
Yeah. Right?
So, for example, we just sent out an insider appeal. And one of the things we stressed on the insider appeal was that if you are suffering, we understand. But if you're not, and you have capacity, please remember those who cannot afford to give at their regular level this year, and try to see if you can cover them. I think we did it more elegantly than what I just said, but something to that effect. To remind people that this is an extraordinary time, and some of us are doing quite well, even with everything going on, and some people are really, really struggling.
Yeah.
So, we tried to put that message out there, and also, especially, we serve a community that's incredibly bifurcated, and I think a lot of social organizations, it's funny, when I worked in the theater world or the performing arts world, your donor is the person who's coming to see the show for the most part. Right? I mean, generally, your donors are going to be the people, quote unquote, that you're serving. Whereas when you're in a social service organization, it's very bifurcated, right? You have the people that you work with, and oftentimes they can barely afford your service if there's a fee. But they're not going to be your donors. It's people in the community around them who recognize the need. And that's a very different type of model, isn't it? But I think it's important to recognize that. And yet there may be people that were former clients that might be interested in supporting your work. So for example, we have it's called our Futuro program. And the Futuro program offers promising high school juniors and seniors from first generation or second generation American families. So they're all immigrant right. families. Private tutoring, mentoring, SAT prep, help with college applications, help understanding the whole college application process, trips to schools. We even give a stipend when they graduate so they can afford to buy books or a laptop computer. So this is offered free of charge to students who maintain a 3.0 average or higher. And the hope is that these people, and oftentimes they do, we have 100% high school graduation rate among this population. 80 to 90% of them go on to higher education. And many of them go on to jobs. We just got an email from the alumna of the Futuro program who's going to work in finance at JP Morgan. Another one who works for our congresswoman. So we want these people in our database to make sure that we include them in future messaging, because the hope is that they will go on to phenomenal careers.
Do you think, I think what has, and I suspect it may be even with the training that you got with the Veritas Group, maybe you talked about this, But I kind of wonder if kind of in the midst, there's sort of a social justice narrative that's sort of playing out right now as a result of a lot of the social unrest that sort of played out during the summer months. And it's the question of whether or not our segmentation, well, then segmentation is not necessarily a sort of a buzzword in there, but it sort of raises the question of whether or not our donors or our non-donors or our non-active donors feel like in some way they're being overlooked. And so when it comes to the conversation of segmentation, it's kind of like the difference between what I would call lane one and lane two fundraising. It's the difference between, you know, everyone in lane one is receiving all the mail. So if you're in the database, you're getting mail. So nobody's overlooking you. And then in lane two, it's that major gift work oftentimes. Mm-hmm. And it's the 100 to 150 names that we assign to the major gift officer.
Right.
And I wonder if part of the message that some of these conversations are having, because I'm not really engaged in them, but are there donors who are actually saying, I want to be on those lists, or there's some sort of injustice if I'm not on those lists? And I kind of want to say to some of these people, look, I don't think that they're begging you to put them on the list. I don't know that they want to hear from your gift officer. I don't know that fundraising in what we would call a major gift sense is where people are going to accuse us of sort of being discriminatory, is sort of what I feel like is being sort of alluded to. Do you follow my thinking?
I'm not 100% sure.
It's the idea that, for example, of sort of inviting people to the table or inviting them to the party. So if I invited 100 people to a party and I didn't invite you, Lorraine, to that party, you may feel like you're being overlooked,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Overlooked, discriminated, forgotten, ignored, whatever.
And when it comes to sort of the
way that most fundraising gets done, when we're talking about sort of the mass market approach to fundraising, everybody gets the mail. Nobody's gonna like not invite you to the table in that sense, right?
Right.
But I don't think that there's donors out there who are prospective donors who are saying, you didn't include me in that major gift officer's list of 150 donors. And so it seems like sort of an ethical dilemma that I don't know is really there, but I feel like in some of my previous conversations, we're sort of edging closer to it. And I don't know if it's a quandary that we've really got to be overly concerned about. You follow my thinking now?
I do, but I'm going to disagree with you because I'll tell you a funny story. I have a friend who, he used to be an actor, and he went to the Actors Fund.
Yeah.
And they helped provide him with funds for him to go back to school and get, I think it was like an MBA, but it was certainly a nice degree that he had. And he got it with support from the Actors Fund. And he's now making quite a nice bit of money.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to him and he's like, you know, they've never asked me for money. They've never asked me for a donation. I'm doing really
okay.
Well.
So that guy. Okay. Right. Yeah. You say you're disagreeing with me. I'm just trying to figure out if the issue is really an issue. So you're saying that there's people out there like that, like this gentleman,
mm-hmm.
You're saying that there's people out there who expect to be called from the major gift officer and offered to say, quote unquote, taken out to lunch to be asked for say a $10,000 gift. That's what you're saying he's expecting.
Maybe. I mean, he was certainly expecting. He was like, "I never even get an email from the master."
Right,
you know. So, I do think I do think that it's important to remember the people that the organization has served, and you know, be mindful of what I'll tell you. I'll give you actually another example. So
okay.
We serve the immigrant Latin, mostly Latin, but not all community in Valdez, Mercer County, Trenton, mostly.
Yeah.
And we had an outdoor event where we gave away backpacks and school supplies and food and some books and toys. And we had about 350 people show up. And we put out a little box that just said, you know, make a donation. It was almost hidden. It was like, and people put money in. Now, these are people who have nothing.
Yes, right.
They have nothing. And, yeah. You know, I think the total that we raised was maybe $20. You know, yeah. It was a very small amount. But for them, it empowered them to feel like they were not taking charity. Even if they just put in a dollar or 50 cents.
I totally get that. I totally get that. But I don't get the assumption that there's somebody, say, for example, in the Latin community there that expects you to call them and take them out to lunch and feels overlooked if you're not taking them out to lunch and asking them for money.
Probably not.
And I mean, so I don't know. And I don't know that we're ever going to be able to I'm just trying to be a pragmatist here and sort of listening to sort of some of the ethical dilemmas that fundraising tends to get itself sort of tied in knots over. Mm. And I just don't know that. I mean, I did. I just had this conversation about segmentation with a woman a couple of weeks ago. And I said, I just don't know if that's really our issue. I think there's other issues that we need to address. Mm-hmm. And wholeheartedly and with good intentions and all of that sort of stuff. But I don't know if that's one of them.
I think I see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I'm not looking at segmentation in that regard. I'm looking at more as the, because especially with a small staff like we have, to do a mailing for 3,000 people is expensive. And I don't know that it's worth its return on investment, right? The amount of time, money, and just human resources that would take for us to do and stamps even. But we did a very targeted, for 100 people, that's manageable, right? And then we're planning on doing some other, you know, larger mailings later in the fall, but, each one has a different type of vehicle. Like we're going to do a couple of e-blasts. We're going to do postcards. We are going to do another letter to another kind of that, not quite second lane, but hopefully moving into the second lane.
Yeah. It's the idea that, you know, segmentation 10, 20 years ago, when I was sort of hearing it for the first time, I don't know that I would have ever heard the suggestion, but I hear the suggestion now that segmentation could be inadvertently accused of essentially some sort of a discriminatory sort of behavior, because to segment is to basically isolate somebody from the list.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know. I don't either. I don't know. And I think about the marketplace, because a lot of our techniques and principles and ideas sort of come from the marketplace. And I don't know. I don't know if in the private sector, you know, some of these large commercial companies necessarily could be legitimately accused of sort of when they're marketing to a particular audience, could be accused of sort of discriminating against an audience that's not interested in their product or service.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you could also look at it in the reverse metric, I guess, reverse lens, probably a better term, which is, you know, I remember a gentleman I know who had learned about an organization and wanted them to know who he was.
Yeah.
And he went on and made what he said was a larger donation than one would expect from a first-time gift.
Yeah.
You know, and that, of course, caught the attention of the development officer and the executive director. And they were like, well, who is this person who just made this gift? You know, I know that I keep, I guess, coming from development, I keep a real close eye on who's making donations.
Yeah.
You know, especially ones that are unsolicited. And then I'm like, okay, who is that? And I make sure that is something I think that all organizations should consider doing. If somebody makes an interesting, you know, for the organization, an interesting first gift, immediately try to find out who they are and find someone to reach out to them. Maybe it's a board member. Maybe it's a maybe it's the officer, depending on the size of the organization and how involved the board is. We got our $1,000 gift, a first time gift from out of the blue from somebody. And it turns out he's like a big, big wig in the industry here. And immediately reached out to our board to say, does anybody know him? And one of our board members said, yeah, I think he plays tennis with my husband. You know, and we made sure that he got a personal thank you from that person. And he's now in our database, and we'll send him some information going forward to make sure that we send him those 7 touches between now and next year.
Yes, I can probably say, I don't know if the rule of 5 holds true, but I can probably say those 7 touches, as you obviously, as Jeff and his team reiterated for you, I have seen those sort of things play out. The other rule I've seen play out is sort of like this 18-month timeline. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the point at which you receive that first gift or some sort of initial gift with the intentions of securing a more meaningful, perhaps a major gift. And it generally is not going to play out within the traditional 12-month, you know, fiscal calendar sort of 12-month year. And so to plan for that is to generally sort of, I have seen the 18-month window sort of play out more and more because part of the strategic thinking there is to sort of get the organization outside of the box of assuming that the renewed level of support, whatever that first gift was, is going to have to be sort of let go of. So let's say the first gift was $5,000. You're going to have to let go of that, of accounting for that renewed level of support in order to get to a more significant level of support within, say, 18 months. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because it's not oftentimes, you know, we got a first gift back in, I don't know, when was it, April, when that stimulus check came through from the government?
Yes, yes. When Trump was writing everybody bonus checks, yes, I do.
Right. And yes. Basically, I reached out to her, and because nobody knew her, and she said that it was her stimulus check because she didn't need it and she wanted to donate it to an organization. She heard that we were doing good work. She was like, I doubt you'll see that money, you know, and doubt it'll be renewed because,
right,
you know, that wouldn't be in her budget. This was extra. And, you know, I wrote back and I was like, understood, but I hope you'll continue to be interested in what we do. And
yeah. And see, that would be a great example of sort of that 18-month rule, because the $4,000 she sent you isn't part of her natural sort of flow of financial planning, we'll call it. You know, it's just not her when she's giving charitably, philanthropically throughout any given 12-month period, that $4,000 doesn't sort of fit.
Right.
And so if you grant that relation, so rather than sort of dropping the ball on that relationship, if you say, okay, we're not going to concern ourselves with renewing that $4,000, but we're going to invest in that relationship, recognizing that perhaps in 18 months, we could actually even raise more money than that. But we've got to afford that relationship time. It's not about the money. It's about affording it the time. I think that's one of the things that undermines a lot of our major gift work. I'm sure you heard that in Jeff's class as well.
Yeah.
Is that we don't afford these relationships sufficient enough time because we're so focused on getting the money.
Yeah.
Yeah, and time usually is what translates into that relationship much more, you know, signals a deliberateness in a relationship much more than the money does.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, as a sort of a side note to other AUDs out there, this is why it's so important for you to retain your development staff, because it is about the relationships, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you, actually, I was kind of surprised about this, but when I came to LALDEF, one of the donors was someone, he's kind of a middle, first lane donor to LALDEF, but I know he's a major donor at another organization where I used to work. And actually, right before I left where I used to work, he had undergone a bone marrow transplant. and he had been out of commission for a good 6 months, and then he was still in kind of loose isolation. He could get visitors, but he couldn't go out into big crowds. This is before the pandemic hit, like probably about a year ago. And I went to visit him in his home, and we had a lovely conversation. And during the conversation, I mentioned I had just joined the board of LALDEF. And yeah. He was like, oh, yeah, I know a little bit about them. And then when I joined the staff at LALDEF, I realized he was a donor. And I was like, okay, I know he has higher potential than what he's doing here. And I've been gently courting him and gently, you know, keeping him in the loop about what's going on. And out of the blue, he sent me an email the other day saying, I see you're the interim. Congratulations. I need to learn more about that organization. Mm-hmm. And that was like we're jumping on a Zoom call in the next week to discuss LALDEF and what we do. And I'm hopeful that it will lead to actually a much larger gift in the very near future.
Yeah, I say you give it 18 months.
Very much.
Don't worry about the rule of five. Don't worry about the rule of five. Maybe the 4.5. But I say give it 18 months. Lorraine, I have we usually lose our listeners after about 30, 35 minutes, and I've already kept you longer than that. And we have gone all over the place.
Yeah.
We've talked about all sorts of things, and I'm excited to hang up with you and to go tell my kids who you are, because especially my older daughter. But nonetheless, if somebody's listening to our conversation today and they want to continue the conversation with you, how would you suggest that they do that?
Sure. So I can be reached at LALDEF. So my email there is lgoodman@laldef.org. Or you can find me on LinkedIn, Lorraine Goodman. That's probably the best. Or you can go to the website, laldef.org, and find me there.
Lorraine, it has been a pleasure. I'm glad you held on and we got you back for take two. And I wish you the best here in the holidays. You're always welcome back. All you got to do is have a big idea or bold opinion, and we'll have a conversation.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.